This morning at my home in southeast Portland, I started the day by reading on my phone about Ukraine and Sudan and Gaza. It seems wrong not to be aware of what's happening in those places, yet I have no clearer or deeper an understanding of Ukraine or Sudan or Gaza than I do of where and how my phone is manufactured, or what global miracles and tragedies put it in my hands. In some small way, I seem to be part of all of these global developments, and they all seem to shape both my private life and our public life. But all of it, the world and its interconnections, seems far too big and complex to navigate. This is one of the many odd things about life in this moment. We are hyper-connected to and dependent on far-off places and people, and at the same time, we seem to be, or at least I certainly am, pretty much incapable of understanding, let alone affecting, all these global relationships or the structures behind them. But a few people do seem to understand this stuff, to have a rare window into the global system and where we, as individuals and as a nation, might fit in. Ben Rhodes is one of these people. For 8 years, he was a national security advisor, speechwriter, and sounding board to President Barack Obama. He's since written 2 really thoughtful books about that experience, After the Fall and The World as It Is, and he hosts the appealingly accessible podcast Pod Save the World. We talked with Ben at the Alberta Rose Theater in Portland in late January 2025 as part of our Consider This series on the theme, The People and the Public. And this episode of The Detour starts with a few questions for that night's audience about how they think about our place in the world. Ben picks up from there. If you think of yourself as a participant in the international community, could you make a little noise? If when you think about the United States' role in the world, you think first about our safety, that will be the first option to clap. If when you think about the United States' role in the world, you think principally about global justice, that will be the second option to clap. So if you think, when you think about our role in the world, about the safety of the United States as the top goal. Okay. If you think more about global justice, can you make a noise? I don't know. That's the room.
I got it. Yeah.
You got it? Okay. We'll come back to these questions. The way I want to invite you to start is ask you, can you point to a moment, maybe when you were younger, when you started to feel like, I'm a citizen not just of New York or the United States, but of the world? Like, was there a moment when you started to feel like, this is a community, the international community that I'm a part of?
I remember when I was growing up, my parents had friends who were German, and I really liked them, and they were kind of dramatically German. This guy used to like to blast Beethoven's Ninth Symphony in the mornings and drink champagne. You know, he's exactly what you'd want a German to be. And one thing that was interesting is when I studied abroad in university, I went to stay with them. I was 21 years old. And I noticed that, you know, they had a lot of books about the Nazi era. And, you know, I called my mom and I was like, oh, you're having a great time. And I was like, you know, Peter's got a lot of Nazi books, you know. And she said, you know, well, what you don't know about them is that both of their parents were Nazis. And my mother is Jewish. And this was a kind of jarring thing to learn about these people that I saw as these kind of avuncular aunt and uncle types. But then what I realized over the course of a couple of days with them is that Peter devoted his whole life to this project of working for these institutions that were meant to prevent the reemergence of the Nazi Party. And America was fundamental to that. And my father had met Peter through one of these civil society organizations that were part of that. And it was the first time I was kind of truly conscious of the fact that all these institutions that comprise the quote-unquote international community, or used to, are actually made up of human beings who made choices to avoid history. And that the United States was, in a complicated way, not a perfect way, kind of fundamental to that. And I just remember being at 21, when I had no idea I was going to go into this line of work that I did, just very aware of how that was both inspiring but also kind of scary. This is a human endeavor. It's not like a self-executing endeavor.
That is, international work is these are human beings that are doing this stuff.
Human beings decided to build these institutions. Human beings work at these institutions. And human beings could break these institutions. And, you know, the world suddenly became a more interesting, more interconnected, and yet also more dangerous place when I kind of, the truth of that sunk in.
And so it sounds like that awareness of the fact that it was human beings, some of whom you knew, were taking on the responsibility of shaping that international system, the international institutions. So at first there was awareness, but at some point, you became one of those people.
Yes.
Was that deliberate? Did you say, I want to be someone who shapes the global public, who shapes the international realm, or did you happen upon it? And let me just say, the reason I'm asking is because that feels, I think, for most of us, quite far away.
Yeah, I did not set out to do that at first. The quick version is, I moved back home to New York City after college with every intention of becoming a writer. I saw a future for myself living in, you know, Brooklyn and, you know, smoking pot and writing for magazines and trying to pass a manuscript to an agent and all the rest of that. And I was on that trajectory and it was fun. But I had an interest in politics, and I was working local politics in New York on September 11th, 2001, which was election day. And I was literally handing out flyers in front of a polling station for the city council candidate I was working for in Brooklyn, right on the waterfront. And so I saw the entire 9/11 attacks. And I remember walking home that day to Queens, where I lived, and just thinking, you know, sitting in my small apartment writing short stories about men sitting in small apartments writing short stories. It suddenly felt like an incredibly trivial thing to be doing with myself. And I just wanted to be involved in foreign policy, whatever that meant. I wanted to be involved in the American response to what I saw. And then I ended up in D.C. I just wanted to go down there and write and learn about foreign policy. And that led me to getting a job as a speechwriter for a guy named Lee Hamilton, who ran a think tank there, the Wilson Center. And then even then, I didn't think I was going to be a participant. I wanted to be a writer. But the Bush years kind of radicalized me to want to get involved in politics, because I was like, what's the point of writing about this stuff if the people in charge are going to lie to you and ignore, you know, whatever recommendations blue ribbon commissions and think tanks make? And so I kind of deliberately set out to enter politics, and that's when I went to work for Barack Obama.
In a way, you have a window into the international world that a very small number of people have. Maybe you could give us three phenomena over the past couple decades that you think are the most important things we should think about or understand when we think about the current state of the international situation.
It's a great question. I think 9/11 is one. I think there was a period from the end of the Cold War to 9/11 when America felt like it had kind of escaped history. We could assume that the world that we were living in was going to continue to be like it was for an indefinite period of time, and the United States position was going to be what it was for an indefinite period of time. And then 9/11 happened. And to me, that was like the giant shock to the American system, that you don't get to step out of history. That, frankly, in ways that Americans still don't want to reconcile, you know, that was to some extent blowback for the role that the United States played. Not doesn't justify it, but you know, we can't sit in our country and think that we can do whatever we want around the world and not have people get pissed off at us and try to hurt us. But that kind of led to the creation of a, you know, multi-trillion dollar enterprise of a national security state, of a Department of Homeland Security, of multiple wars, and also the kind of creation of a new form of American nationalism. If you watched, you know, Fox News in the years after 9/11, that was a kind of jingoism that actually I don't remember from the 90s, you know, like there's suddenly their flags on the screen and their enemies and there's a kind of martial nationalism, right, that I think led ultimately to Trump. Let's put the Iraq War under that umbrella because I think that was a profoundly consequential event because that was the event in which a lot of the rest of the world was like, okay, we kind of trusted these guys. They're in the front seat and they have the car keys. And we all kind of trust them to just drive. And now it's like, where are these guys taking the car? It doesn't seem like maybe they're drunk. like, why is this happening? Like, and so I think the kind of implicit trust that, you know, that superpower status relies on was starting to fray. Second event, fundamental event to understanding everything, I think, that we're living through today is the financial crisis. Because the basic premise of globalization was you're going to lose something of your identity, right? There's going to be more movement of people, more movement of ideas, you know, traditional identities are going to kind of be encroached upon. But the bargain was your standard of living is going to keep getting better. And, you know, it's going to be good for not just the people at the top, but working classes and that was erased with the financial crisis. And as bad as the financial crisis was in this country, it was worse almost everywhere else. And so in Orban, and I wrote about him a lot in this book, who's a kind of obviously a flavor of Trump in Hungary, just very astutely sensed that the populist backlash to the financial crisis will not inevitably come from the left. It could actually come from the right. Because I could basically say, I'm going to embrace the oldest form of politics there is, which is kind of national tribal identity politics. And I'm going to connect that to a critique of an establishment of globalization that people are really angry at. But instead of my answer being kind of Bernie Sanders economics, my answer is going to be we have to return to a traditional sense of national identity. And we the them to the us is the immigrants and the globalists and the liberal elites and, you know, the Muslims and, you know, the fact that the backlash to the financial crisis and kind of the failure of globalization was captured by the right, I think has done a lot to shape global politics since. And all 8 years in Obama, I could feel us kind of running in the opposite direction or swimming in the opposite direction of the currents, you know. And then very quickly, the last one, and I'm deliberately kind of predating even Obama, because I think we've been living through the aftermath of these structural forces. I'd say the 2008 Beijing Olympics, because that was an event in which China, which had been kind of biding its time and kind of drafting behind the United States to develop their economy, shifting towards this kind of state-controlled capitalism out of communism, embracing technology. All of a sudden, they're like, here we are. Like, we can put on a better opening ceremony than any of you people. We're rich. We're powerful. We're not going to stay in the shadows anymore. And we have an entirely different system. And if you're in the developing world, if you're in the global South, you're like, well, wait a second. Maybe the Americans don't have the only model. And frankly, Americans are kind of jerks to us. And we could be like these people instead. And or we can shop around and we can work with the Americans on some things and the Chinese on others. So those three things were all obviously hugely destabilizing to the world I came of age in the 90s because they rattled American confidence and created American nationalism, upended the assumptions of globalization, and created competitors to the United States, which puts us into a period of both political instability in our own country, but also global instability and conflict.
Thank you for that really cogent response to a probably unanswerable question. And thank you also for the surprising to me number three.
I mean, it was cool.
And any list, it was cool. It was cool, but it sounds to me like in all three of those that in a way some of what's happening is perception of a threat which might have been less detectable before. And so I want to ask a question about the idea of threats and the international system. As you were working on national security, were you sorting between friends and enemies? Is there another country that can be considered simply a friend, or is it all threats?
I'm a fairly unconventional person to have been, you know, a deputy national security advisor for 8 years, so I acknowledge that. And so I thought less in those terms probably than other people did. They're definitely friends. I mean, and it's very striking. There are kind of three kinds of countries, you know, if I had to generalize, right? If we met with the British, the meaning was, hey, we all agree on what we're trying to do everywhere. Like, what's the play we're running? You know, you're starting from a place of agreement. Then there are countries that, you know, that you have a relationship with where, you know, there's things you're working together on, there are things you disagree on, there are things that they want the United States to be doing, and you're trying to figure out whether you can do it. And that's, you know, a lot of the medium-sized Latin American, Asian, and African nations. And then there, you know, Russia, you know, is an adversary. And every meeting is basically you're going through a list of things where you don't agree and you're just trying to either manage that or be confrontational or try to find some opening to do something. You know, what's interesting is I spent 8 years looking at power from the ultimate inside out place, you know, from in the Situation Room in the Oval Office or out the window of a motorcade or inside some other government building. I went on every single foreign trip Obama took as president. I've spent 8 years working really hard to reprogram myself to look at power from the outside in. And what I've come to see is that it's not countries that interest me as much as people. And that there are people in countries that are friends of ours that I disagree with and people in countries that are adversaries of ours that I am very like-minded with. And not that I've figured everything out, but I think that's kind of what's missing, you know, that capacity to kind of not oversimplify things, but to try to find solidarity with people who are like-minded about certain things in different places and build from that.
When you talked about, for example, a difficult meeting with your Russian counterparts and trying to figure out what you want to get out of it, I think I want to ask you a question about how clear you had to be around goals in the international system, sort of like that the very oversimplified question about safety or justice that people responded to very much on the justice side, which I imagine, and maybe I'm wrong, I imagine that the role of anyone in government is really to focus first on the safety side.
Yeah, well, if you take the Russians in particular, so in the first Obama term, you had a leader in Dmitry Medvedev. He saw a pathway to Russian kind of prestige, and a lot of Russian psychology is just about wanting to have the stature of a great power. He saw that pathway as connected to working with Americans, you know, and kind of being in the room with Barack Obama and making deals. And so we did a whole range of things. An example I'd give of like a goal that is in safety and justice space, right, is that we negotiated a nuclear arms treaty, and inherently that is in our safety interest. But importantly, what we tried to do with that is say, hey, we're doing this because it's in service of the more global effort to reduce the spread of nuclear weapons, right? The core of the nuclear nonproliferation treaty, which you know most people don't think a lot about, is that the countries with nuclear weapons agree to give up their nuclear weapons. And they may not do it overnight, but you know, we want to see them working in that direction. And then that's the basis under which you can tell all the other countries who don't have nuclear weapons and you can't have them. You know, mm-hmm. You know, we're strengthening a norm so that we can go to other countries and say, let's kind of pressure the Iranians to make an agreement to not develop their nuclear weapons. And Medvedev brought that mentality to a lot of things, even though we couldn't get to yes on everything with him. What was interesting is when Putin came back to power, to put a human element on it, we'd heard rumblings that Medvedev wanted to stick around in the presidency. And I think those were true. But ultimately, Putin, you know, yanked the rug out from under him, said, I'm coming back. And I'll never forget, like, the first G8 summit. The first one after Putin was elected, Putin didn't show up, which is, you know, typical of Putin. It was kind of a message. And these Medvedev people, this is their last turn on the global stage. And Medvedev was watching, like, a European soccer game on his iPad the whole time. He's checked out. But the point is, what they knew is what was coming. Because when Putin came back, he had no interest in what I just described. It was like, I'm coming back. I'm just not going to work with you guys on anything. And you're just going to have to adjust to a reality in which there's no more arms control. There's no more global cooperation. And it just shifted very quickly. And it was just like one of those pivot points in history, you know. And so while Russia, the country, has its own interests and the human element, right? Like sometimes there's a Vladimir Putin, and that just changes what you can do in the room, you know?
So that last comment you just made, sometimes there's Vladimir Putin and you need to respond to that. And what you said about norms a moment ago, I want to keep both of those out, but I also, when you talked about Medvedev watching European soccer, like sometimes it feels like for me, and I think for many people I know, that's about as close as we're going to get. It can feel like this world out there that's very distant from the even the public world that many of us find ourselves in all the time. So the question I want to ask is, how do most of us, if at all, bring what we have to bear on that world?
You know, at the end of the day, these people wake up and get dressed in the morning, right? They're just like us, these politicians, these political leaders, even these strongmen. And they ultimately are responsive to public opinion in their countries and the world. And if you doubt that, then just consider the amount of effort that is made every day in all parts of the world to make you think that you have no agency in the world. Like it's a design, and it stretches across social media, politics, money in politics, business. But ultimately, all these things are a reflection of where societies are going. And there are things that, you know, are beyond our control. Like I can't end the war in Ukraine or the war in Gaza. But, you know, a lot of issues actually play out much closer to the ground. If you're interested in a country or an issue or a cause, it's actually much easier to get involved than you think. Or frankly, just understanding the world that you're living in, I think is an act of resistance and of affirmation, because a lot of effort is made to make you not understand the world, you know? And I think the ultimate international community is just people figuring it out for themselves in the spaces where they live, and then acting in ways that will affect the culture over time. And I think the clearest manifestation of that has been on the American right for the last 15 years, where there's been a lot of civil society and organization and solidarity with like-minded, you know, right-wing or far-right parties around the world. You know, I mean, look at what they did, you know? So yeah, there's more ways than you think to kind of plug in.
Thank you. That, again, really provocative and helpful response. Understanding. You just made it sound like understanding alone has value. And as I was reading your books and reading the paper and thinking about our country and other countries, like these days, it's very hard for me to understand my own country. I think I used to think I understood it some. Now I don't think I understand it barely at all. And that's the country that speaks my language, that I've grown up in. How much confidence, when you were going from place to place, did you have that you understood enough about what was going on in these different countries to develop policies, to, in some cases, put lives at risk? Like, how much did you have to understand? How confident could you be about understanding other countries and cultures?
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. government, first of all, has a massive amount of resources that are designed to help you understand. From like a very capable diplomatic corps to aid workers to intelligence reporting, I had an interesting perspective because the national security guy that I was, you're not wired to try to understand the countries. You're just there to advance American interests. And if you can find a guy who's smart about that country to help you do that, that's great. But as a speechwriter for Barack Obama who wanted to connect with people, I would have to kind of, you know, start a habit of talking to people from those countries, you know, people in civil society or just contacts or writers from those countries. And I would try to gather those perspectives to inform what Obama would say in places. And, you know, you're not going to get to know a place entirely well, but you know what? You are going to be smarter because you're going to know what to avoid, you know, and you're going to know what the grievances are. And if I have a criticism of the entire enterprise that I was a part of, to shorthand it quickly, you know, in the last 8 years, I've gotten to know a lot of Afghans. I just have like a kind of an Afghan diaspora friend group. And it got me really thinking hard about the fact that I was in hundreds of meetings in the White House situation about Afghanistan, military strategies in Afghanistan, economic strategies in Afghanistan, development strategies in Afghanistan. And there was never a single Afghan in the room. And, you know, that's why you get the result that we got, you know. And Americans do this time and again. And, you know, to also name another uncomfortable truth, the further you get from Europe, i.e. the further you get from other white people, the less America understands the mentality and worldview and interests and grievances and intellectual origins of places. And if you look at American foreign policy since World War II, the further you get from Europe, the less successful American foreign policy tends to be.
So there's something about the argument that you're making there that that is like beautifully harmonious, which is that the more we understand other cultures, the more likely it is that we will achieve our interests.
Yeah, I truly believe that. Yeah, and it's a radical idea in American foreign policy. Yeah.
Say a little more about that.
I think that there's something about power that makes people feel like they have less reason to understand the interests, right? You know, power does corrupt in the sense that it makes you feel immune from having to think through what you're doing. You would think that Russians would understand Ukrainians better than maybe anybody else outside of Russia, given the proximity, but clearly they didn't understand Ukrainians. You know, if you think of another country as another human being, you wouldn't think that the best way to achieve your objectives is to just tell that other human being exactly what you're going to do and expect them to be completely okay with it. You know, you'd want to get to know that person. And, you know, and so think of countries like people, I mean, because that's what they are. And, you know, Obama is imperfect, obviously, and I'm not here to suggest everything that is right. But I do think that he was unique as an American president because he was black, and so he'd been on the other, inherently on the other end of power in this country. Because he'd lived in Indonesia as a boy, which is a country where the CIA just sponsored a coup that led to hundreds of thousands of deaths. He kind of had an intuitive understanding of the world doesn't see America like we see the movie of ourselves, mm-hmm. you know. And actually, good presidents have had that that capacity too in the past. We have not had that recently. In both parties.
You're listening to The Detour with Ben Rhodes, host of Pod Save the World and author of After the Fall.
So you just said, think of countries like people. What's your read on human nature? What's your read on how nations interact? And should we assume that nations want primarily to understand each other or to compete is a version of what I'm like, is the international system even more cutthroat than it might be between people because it's agglomerations of people and getting back to national identity and borders?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about countries like people, the overuse of power works really well until it doesn't. What's amazing about human beings is their complete incapacity to learn that lesson. And if you just look at the cycles of history, if you start to ignore the interests of other countries, if you start to think that you have impunity from any kind of international, let's not even say law, gravity, if you assume that people are not going to band together to resist the way in which you're overusing or abusing power, everybody's learned that lesson. Let's just take the West, but I could apply it elsewhere. You know, the Athenians learned it, the Romans learned it, you know, the British learned it, and we're learning it right now. And we are acting in a very obvious late stage empire way. You know, the shorthand a foreign policy person would give is, you know, that there's an enlightened self-interest whereby by binding our own power and constraining our own power, we can trade that for a more stable world and more shared benefit. It's also that capacity to look at other human beings who are different from us and find that interesting instead of threatening. And I'll just wade into dangerous waters here too. Like, I have friends who just, they'll look at the Palestinians in Gaza and all they see is Hamas. And in addition to that being, I think, a narrow mindset, it's actually a sad one because those are interesting people. Talk to them. And you can guess what you'll figure out. They're exactly the same as you are. They just live in a different place and look different. You know, I mean, that's my experience globally, is that everybody's pretty similar with a lot of different culture layered on top of them, but that's what makes it interesting. Like, wouldn't you like to meet the people that eat somewhat different food and listen to different music and have different heroes and different myths? That should be a good thing. And I want to live in a world where that's a good thing and not something to be scared of.
And as towards the end of that comment, you talked about the world you wanted to live in, which of course points back to the title of your memoir, The World As It Is, which is different from the world as it ought to be. The title of your more recent book, After the Fall, and even the name of the podcast you work on, Pod Save the World, which is a jokey title, but there's nothing jokey about the verb save. And as I was thinking about those three titles and the tenor of your books and the work you've done, there's like a spiritual and moral yearning in it, which feels very unusual to see in the international arena.
Yeah, I had to kind of deliberately make a journey the last 8 years, you know, away from a certain way of thinking that I had been wired to think. I had to kind of not just like relinquish power, but I had to kind of not want it anymore. So I had to not like self-censor how I talked about certain things because maybe 8 years from now I'll be read back to me at a confirmation hearing, you know. I had to be willing to have people who are friends be annoyed, if not mad at me, about what I was saying on my podcast, you know. And I don't see the virtue signal because I'm the one who benefited. It was like, I don't want to be suffocated by the machinery that I came out of 8 years ago. You know, I want to explore what it's like to be in the world in different ways. And I guess, you know, one thing I would say to people who are probably feeling, you know, like I am, is, okay, it's not great. And to take it very seriously, there are people much more vulnerable than me who we need to be very concerned about. At the same time, you don't get to choose the times that you live in. It would be really nice to live in a time where I always felt like the government reflected who I was, where I didn't have to worry about some of these things. But looked at from another way, hey, like, we're in it, you know? We are in a period that matters. And if we all just check out and tune out, we know how those periods end. And this is where I'll differ from kind of where people were in the first Trump term. It's not going to be as simple as like, get out there, therefore, and organize and try to win the next election. I actually think it's deeper than that. It's like, how can we regenerate within ourselves and our own communities a shared sense of belonging? What does it mean to be an American? What does that even mean anymore? I think I could have answered that question easier in 1990 than I could today. And we all kind of need to do this work of thinking about why are we here, you know, and it's not enough to wish somebody else won an election. You have to kind of think about, well, why do I want that person to win the election? Or what kind of person would I like to see who's not running for office? And so, I don't know. I think we have to be asking the bigger questions now.
Okay. I have one last question before we open questions over here. I think just one, and it's related to what you just said. It's also related to what you said before about wanting to talk to people and that we're all the same. One of the stories we tell ourselves and declare in public regularly is that this is an exceptional nation, that there's something unusual about us. Seen many countries, you've interacted with many people running many countries. Do you feel like we're an exceptional nation, or are we one nation like all other nations?
We are exceptional in the sense that we're weirdly large and diverse, and people came from everywhere to be here, and so, you know, we weren't founded in a fixed ethnicity or religion, you know, even though some people thought we were. But in my experience in politics, there are kind of two narratives of American exceptionalism. And one is that, like, we're just exceptional. You know, what America does is kind of inherently right because we're America. We're a city on a hill. You know, we're the heirs of the Greeks and the Romans. You know, we are, you know, the Rome of today. And if we do something wrong, it's still right because we did it, you know. And I know I'm short-ending it, but I actually think that's what a lot of people believe, you know, that there's something kind of inherently just in our actions. And if there's an occasional Vietnam or Iraq, like, well, you know, better that we're out there in the world doing this stuff, you know, because we're America. And I come out of a political tradition that sees American exceptionalism as our capacity to fix what is wrong with America. And, you know, obviously Obama was a president who came out of the civil rights movement, which came out of the abolition and justice movements of the 19th century. This argument goes all the way back to the founding fathers, right? You know, who is American? Who gets to decide? You know, are we essentially that room where the Constitution was written, which is a bunch of white male property owners? Or are we all the movements ever since that have just tried really hard to let more people be American, have the full rights of Americans, whether they be black, whether they be women, whether they be immigrants? And, you know, Obama would talk about this internationally, and it was interesting. Then I wrote all these speeches, and the Republicans said he was on an apology tour. And what used to drive me nuts about that is that he never actually said sorry. He said, you know, America had all these problems, but what makes America great is our capacity to steadily try to fix them, you know. And so I actually thought it was what was being cast as this kind of un-American message, I thought was this patriotic message, you know. And so you have this kind of duality of exceptionalism. Is our exceptionalism our capacity to change, or is our exceptionalism something in our past that we have to recapture, make America great again, you know? And it's that kind of dueling exceptionalism that that we've never resolved and kind of speaks to the profound conflicts around identity that we're dealing with today. But then when you travel around the world, I think you also come to see every nation is exceptional and has their own narrative with its own wellsprings and its own currents and its own debates. And frankly, what makes America more interesting to me is that all those wellsprings and currents have fed into us because people have come here from all those places. We're the only country that every other country kind of follows what happens here. And what are they seeing?
So as we transition to questions, can we say an initial preliminary big thanks to Ben? Thank you.
My question is, with losing this much status on the global stage, how do we ever redeem that as our country, as a country that has integrity and care for others? Like, what does that look like to you?
Yeah, to me, it means that we are, I mean, to take a home example, we're in need of a complete rebuild, not a renovation. You know, in the sense that, like, Trump comes in, he's kind of like Trump light. It's like MAGA light, because there really were all these kind of guardrails. The people who worked for him didn't, you know, really support what he's doing. And, you know, a lot of people stood up to him. And then, you know, Biden comes in, and the kind of whole premise was, and I'm not being wholly negative, because it was understandable premise, you know, we'll just keep doing things the way that they seem to be working before, and that will get us past this. And it clearly didn't, you know. And there are a lot of reasons for that. But the point is that there's no going back. And this is why I made the point about not just winning one election. Like, we have to be thinking about not like what we want to restore or return to. This is like a hurricane coming through. Like, how are we going to rebuild out of this? And maybe that's not the worst thing, because America is not the same country that built those institutions in the 40s and 50s or the 90s. And so the opportunity in this, which, you know, I don't want to minimize the dangers, it's going to have to be different than it was before. And I don't have the answer. But you know what? Like, we all have to acknowledge that. Like, I have some ideas, but let's start by saying, like, let's be curious about figuring that out together.
Earlier in your talk, you were talking about even autocrats, say, are vulnerable to peaceful, broad-based opposition to them. So the first question is, what's the mechanism that makes an autocrat vulnerable to widespread peaceful opposition? The other part relates to just what you were saying about rethinking what it means to be American and what America could be. Do some of us have to figure that out first before we are in peaceful opposition, or can it be in parallel or in some other sequence? Thank you.
Yeah, so I'd say there are political movements, political protests, political assembly, political speech that matters. But also, there are cultural and socio and economic factors that autocrats are mindful of. If you look at the Chinese Communist Party, it's interesting. They broke no dissent. But there became a point, they had this zero tolerance COVID policy that was incredibly draconian and incredibly intrusive, and people had huge limitations. And at a certain point, like, a lot of people in China were just like pissed off about that. And these were not political dissidents. And there was a mood in that country that the Chinese Communist Party changed their COVID policies in like a week, you know, and it was like on a dime. And that was not something that they had planned to do, you know. So the first point is that it's, yes, you want vanguard activists and you need them. But there's a broader sense of public opinion. It's actually often not the protests in the street. It's that kind of mood that can shift over time. And what you constantly find in American history is that there is a movement that has to start to redefine what America is, what it means to be American. And then there's a person that comes along and kind of captures it. To take the Trump example, Trump is impossible without the movement of, you know, the Tea Party and all the work even before that to build a kind of right-wing civil society and energy and you know, there's a lot to that. But then the charismatic figure comes along and there's an army that's already been built, you know. And so I think that we need to remember that. It's not just organizers waiting around to be led. It's organizers and people in communities kind of and building movements and making changes. Look, the pendulum's going to swing back. It always does in this country. It swings back and forth. And there'll be another person, and it doesn't have to be Michelle Obama. Like, it shouldn't be. It should be someone that we're not thinking of, right? But it's that interplay between civil society and culture that will then make the next politician better. And that's what we need.
I want to go back to where we started the evening with the question. And I understand why you posed the question this way. It was like, do you want safety or do you want global justice? Yes. And my thought was, that's an asshole question. And so, Mr. Rhodes, my question for you is, how much do you think those two overlap?
Thank you for the kind question.
Look, I'm somebody that believes that a world of justice is a safer world. And I'll never forget, so I negotiated the normalization of relations with Cuba. And we've had this insane policy towards Cuba for, you know, 60 years where we just punish the hell out of these people and expect them to embrace democracy. and so my old premise of this was, look, let's end that policy, open things up, and let the Cubans figure it out, you know, and actually that will inherently be a safer, better thing. And I remember the last week of the Obama administration, I was in Havana and I had dinner with Raul Castro, and we drank a lot. We had like many bottles of rum. I don't know how I managed to do this, but and he was telling all these stories. He's a Castro, you know, he talks a lot, and even more than me. And you know, when I raised Trump, he's like, there was once a Russian general here from Ossetia who had the ability to launch nuclear weapons from Cuba without even telling us, that would have led to the destruction of this island. So I've dealt with worse things than Trump, you know? And so at the end of the dinner, I was like, I just want to ask you, were you guys all communists who wanted to be in the Soviet bloc, or did we kind of, you know? And before I could finish the question, and I believe him. I mean, you know, I'm sure the hardliners will think this is naive Ben Rhodes, but he was pretty drunk. And he looks at me and he pounds on the table and says, it was you. You gave us no option. We had nowhere to go but the Soviets. There was nobody else who would trade with us. There was nobody else who would give us. And I believe that. And oftentimes we do things in the name of safety that make us less safe. And because by pushing them in the arms of Soviets, we got nuclear weapons in Cuba, you know? And so look, my circle is very overlapping. It's not entirely. I might be wrong to some extent because the world is a kind of a tough place too, and people do horrible things to each other, and there's something to the fact that you can't assume good intentions in everybody, you can't. And so that circle, my circle may be too aligned, but I'm telling you, it's definitely more aligned than, sorry, the goal. Question. Yeah. And but you know, you're right to ask it because it actually surfaced this dynamic, right?
It was the goal. That was what I was after.
I've been in politics. So I just think I overlap them, you know, 80%.
And as we go to these last few questions, let's try to make them neither asshole questions nor long questions. Thank you.
I'll try, I swear. I feel like since 9/11 until now, the hate for South Asian and as well as like Middle Eastern immigrants has increased overall, just because of the way we look. And no administration, in my opinion, has done enough. So do you see any hopes for these kind of people in the U.S.?
Yeah. I agree with you that not every administration has done nearly enough. I think the negative version of the story is tied to 9/11. You know, when a superpower fails to win wars, they increasingly turn to enemies within. So if you were consuming right-wing media the last 20 years, it started, we're going to go off and conquer, you know, the Middle East and win great victories. And when that didn't happen, is when you started to see the lens turn inward. And suddenly we're mad at the people who are here, who are brown or from South Asia, or they're Muslim, or then the border becomes a fixation. And I think the way to build back from that, which is again a common thread of the conversation, is beginning in communities themselves. I don't think this kind of broken brain thing that you would see in certain parts of our politics and media is going to change soon, but communities can have different attitudes towards immigrants. Universities can have different attitudes towards students. Frankly, universities can choose to not be bullied by, you know, Pete Hegseth and, you know, the anti-woke, you know, whatever brigades, and be welcoming, because in the end, it's much better. It's kind of boring just, you know, sitting around with a bunch of white people talking to each other in this country.
You mentioned this idea of feeling like you were swimming against a current during your 8 years working at the Obama administration. I often also feel like a lot of the things that are going on in our world today were set in motion by things that I had no control over.
Yeah,
I wasn't born when 9/11 happened, wasn't alive when the Iraq War started. I think I was 3 in 2008. My question is just, to what extent are we victims of history, and to what extent are the thoughts of the people in our communities dictated by these events that we don't have
Great
control
question.
Over?
How old are you?
19.
19. So, you know, number two things. When I was 19, it was 1997. Man, think of what's happened since then. You know, the point is, like, things are going to change. Like, a lot is going to happen in the next 20 years. It's totally unpredictable. If things can swing the ways they have before, they can swing back, too. And you have to remember that, like, we keep thinking everything is permanent and inevitable, or all is lost or all is won, and it's much, you know, everything is more fluid than that. And then my second piece of advice to you is, if there is something that is trying to make you think that you don't have control, that's the thing that you should ignore. So a social media platform that is trying to just feed you a steady diet of some information, don't do that. Like, seek out other information. You know, there's a lot of forces that are designed to make you feel like the individual doesn't have agency in history, but it does, because it did for them. You know, like, look at how much Trump has changed things. That was an individual in history, surfing the backs of a lot of other individuals. And so, seriously, like, everybody, think about your own interaction on a day-to-day basis with power. It's much more constant than you think it is. I mean, every time you look at your phone, you're interacting with power, you know? And think of ways to kind of take control of your own thinking. Because what you may not get to decide history, but you get to decide how you live in history.
Thank you. You mentioned that America is following the same actions as crumbling empires of the past. Do you think that the decline of American empire is inevitable? If not, what might reverse or postpone that trend? And if it is, how will America have to adapt to that loss of status?
I think what we're, it's a great question. Okay, Reed College is great. Look, I'll say we are dealing with it poorly. Part of why you get Trump is it's a nation sensing a loss of status. And that's a very ripe time for a strong man to come along and say, we shouldn't lose status. And I mean, it's very telling. Who's he picking on? You know, Panama, Colombia, Greenland. It's like a bully going out on the schoolyard being like, you know what? I've lost some status because I was embarrassed. So I'm going to find some small people to go beat up, you know, and that's kind of what's happening, right? But at the same time, importantly, it's America's not going to go away, though. And America's going to always, for the lifetime of anybody in this room, absent a complete collapse of American society, which is not totally out of the realm, but we're going to be a big, powerful country with huge influence in the world and a military superpower and an economic power and a cultural power. We have to get comfortable with that being enough, with not being able to tell everybody what to do and not being able to kind of pick the governments of smaller countries. Like, we have to let go a little bit, and be okay with that. And I think that's what people are having a hard time with, but it's kind of, we have to psychologically adjust to being in an international community that we aren't necessarily the captain of, but we are important in it. And that's apparently going to take some time.
I wanted to ask you a question that I've struggled with a little bit and just thought about a lot, which is, why do people listen to us as a country? Is it because we have these advanced forms of government and fair elections and things like that? Or is it because we can, bomb them and destroy their culture? Or is it both?
It's all of the above, and it's a really important question. It's a great question to end on, because a lot of people listen to us because they have to, because whether they like it or they don't, stuff we do is going to matter in their lives. We could bomb their country, or their cousin wants to study here, or their undocumented cousin lives here and sends remittances home, or they have a trading relationship with us and terrorists would affect them. Or, there are very practical reasons why people follow what happens in America. But I will tell you, as someone who's felt the tug of cynicism a lot over the years, I interact with a lot of people in global activism, civil society, a lot. And I've never been anywhere where someone didn't point to something about America that they found motivating, because it's still a pretty radical notion that there's some capacity for social mobility, or that there might be minority figures who can rise to the top of politics or culture or athletics or whatever the thing is. If you think about what people like the absolute most about America, it tends to be culture, right? Music, sports, movies. And all of that culture tends to be the blended America, right? And sometimes it's like expropriation, but whatever you want to think of rock and roll being or hip hop, it couldn't have emerged out of anywhere other than the kind of weird mix of people that live in America, And people around the world see that, and it has a kind of powerful psychological grip. One way to think about these identity issues is to kind of step back and be like, what do I love about American identity and culture? And how do I build out from that in trying to reconstruct an American identity that makes sense to me?
You've been listening to The Detour from Oregon Humanities. Anna McLean is our new producer. Welcome, Anna. We're delighted you're here. Anna is succeeding The Detour's founding producer, Kieran Bond. Thank you, Kieran, for all you brought to the show and to everyone you've worked with. Alexander Sylvester, Karina Brisky, and Ben Waterhouse are our assistant producers. Kyle Gilmer is our audio engineer. This is Adam Davis. Thank you for listening. See you next time.